Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. Yesterday, in part one of this two-part presentation, I told you how the bloody 1925 prison break went down. Now let's follow our three intrepid crooks as they try to live on the lam in this, the second and final part of the story. The three survivors made their way to a farm just outside of New Era, where they threw themselves on the mercy of the farmer there, C.L. Newman. It's not clear whether Newman was part of the New Era Spiritual Society commune at New Era, but he probably was because he took a very Mount of Olives discourse-inspired approach with the convicts, taking them in and feeding them and letting them rest peacefully. He didn't report the convicts' visit until well after they were on their way, which led him in for some bitter words from local officials. Newman, though, bluntly replied that he was not going to put his family's safety at risk by taking sides in a quarrel that he saw himself as having no part in between the state and the prisoners. Eventually, though, the convicts did have to move on. So, after writing an account of the breakout in which they claimed Oregon Jones had done all the killing and pledged never to be taken alive, they left Newman's farmstead Eden, aiming to get far enough away to make a clean break. Near the town of Bingen in southern Washington, Murray, the leader of the crew, wanted to go east, but Kelly and Willows thought north was a better option, so the gang split up. Murray drifted into a train yard in Centralia, where he started looking for a morally flexible drifter who might help him pull a holdup to get some traveling money. He found one in Philip Carson, a 26-year-old hobo from Portland. Or so he thought. Carson paid to rent a cheap hotel room in which they could plan the job and told him he knew an experienced stick-up man who would help for a cut of the take. Then out Carson went to get his friend from the local police station. One of the local cops on duty, C.D. Pilling, quickly changed into civilian clothes and came back with him. Soon Carson was introducing Murray to Pilling, and a few minutes later Pilling and Murray had hatched a full plan to knock over a nearby roadhouse. Then Carson and Pilling went out to hire a car and returned with George Barner, the mayor of Centralia, behind the wheel of his own car. Needless to say, Murray never made it to the roadhouse for the stick-up. Back he went to Salem in careful custody to face his reckoning. But he never received it. On May 10, 1926, as it became increasingly clear that he was headed straight to the gallows, Murray hanged himself in his holding cell. By that time, the other two were back in custody as well. Ellsworth Kelly and James Willows got off to a bad start on their own when, sticking around Bingen to try to raise traveling money, they burgled E.G. Lewis's general store. The haul was pitiful, about $18, but they helped themselves to some of the merchandise as well. This turned out to be a huge mistake because they stole new shoes for themselves and left the packaging behind. And that is how the police learned that whoever robbed that store wore the same size shoes as two of the escaped prisoners from Oregon. They then broke into the town marshal's house, not realizing that he was still inside and asleep. Luckily for everyone involved, he did not wake up. They stole some money, tried and failed to steal the marshal's car, and continued on their way. Further down the road, they found an overland sedan, which they managed to start and in which they fled. But they wouldn't get far in it. The next day, a posse of Multnomah County cops driving to Bingen saw a track of freshly smashed down foliage leading off the highway through brush into a deep canyon. Leaving their car at the road, the four of them stealthily followed the trail on foot to where the car was parked out of sight of the road, and both convicts were sitting on the ground in front of it with sandwiches in their hands. Their surprise was complete, and they were back in Salem almost before Murray was. In his suicide note, Murray tried to save the other two from the noose by claiming he had shot one guard, Oregon Jones had shot the other, and Kelly and Willows hadn't even fired a gun. He needn't have bothered. Under the law, when an illegal operation ends with innocent blood spilled, every member of the criminal conspiracy is considered just as responsible as every other member. It took some time. Convictions were appealed, and the Supreme Court even had to weigh in. But in the end, it was all for nothing, and finally, on April 20th, 1928, Ellsworth Kelly and James Willows were hanged. The 1925 prison break had a big effect on the state prison. Warden Dalrymple, as mentioned before, had been given the job for political reasons, and he was paired up with J.V. Sterrett, a state parole officer. Sterrett was actually on the Ku Klux Klan's payroll. He was like a Kleagle or something like that. And he had done a yeoman's job getting out the clown vote to elect Pierce as governor. The position of parole officer had been his reward. But like a lot of people to whom membership in a gang of secret vigilante terrorists was appealing, Sterrett was always hungry for more power and contemptuous of rules. By 1925, Sterrett and Dalrymple were openly feuding, and everyone at the prison, guards and prisoners alike, had learned how to play them off against each other. That, of course, all came to a screeching halt after this bloody fiasco happened. Both Dalrymple and Sterrett were given their walking papers, along with five guards who retired early, and the prison was taken over by Warden J.W. Lilly, former sheriff of Gilliam County. Order was restored, and the next time a disturbance broke out, a food fight in the dining hall that escalated into a 200-man riot, Warden Lilly himself ran to the scene with a gun and fired over a dozen shots into the crowd, critically wounding at least one man. The Oregon State Pen was always a pretty awful place. But under Lilly, it became at least a little more predictable and less dangerous to its neighbors. And probably a little bit less clanny, too. Key sources of this story included A Cycle of Crisis and Violence, The Oregon Penitentiary, a master's thesis by Joseph Willard Leyte, published in 1992 by PSU, in the archives of the Roseburg News Review and Oregon Statesman. Also correspondence with historian Peter Ballant of Portland. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for eight of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.